entered was decorated with the kind of perfect furniture you found only in a house that had too many rooms. According to the blueprint he'd been given, under it would be the safe room. "Still the gun," Bleeder said in his mind as she leaped over a sofa, heading toward the wall, which hid the steps down to the safe room.
"Useless. I cannot be killed with that."
Wax raised vindication and sighted, then fired, pushing the bullet forward in a burst of extra speed. It hit Bleeder as she landed, right in the ankle. The bone shattered, and Bleeder collapsed as she tried to put weight on her ankle. She turned toward Wax, lips raised in a snarl visible through the broken side of the mask. Wax put a bullet through the eyehole in the mask.
"This is meaningless."
He strode forward, shooting her in the hand as she tried to raise her gun. Wax pulled out the syringe, ready to push it toward her skin, but she growled and became a blur. Wax tried to follow that blur, but at that moment, the side of the room burst open, revealing the hidden stairwell. A group of men in black suits and shotguns piled out, frantic. The governor's special security. Wax dove for cover as they started firing. He didn't catch much of what happened next as he put his back to the side of a thick chair. Bleeder moved among the men, firing. They tried to fire back, doing more damage to their friends than they did to her. It was over by the time the report from the first gunshot had faded in Wax's ears. Men lay groaning and bleeding on the floor, and Bleeder was through the hole and heading down the steps. Wax set his jaw and pushed himself across the room. He landed, skidding on the blood, and leaped into the stairwell. Another push sent him soaring down the steps. Gunshots resounded in the narrow confines of the stairwell, coming from just ahead. Wax slowed himself with a shot forward into the ground, landing beside one final handful of guards who lay bleeding on the floor. The Condor stood alone before the door to the safe room. She looked at Wax, smiled, and became a blur. But her speed only lasted a fraction of a second. Soon after she'd begun tapping her metal mind, she slowed back down. Wax caught sight of her just as she unlocked the door to the governor's safe room, using a key she shouldn't have. She pulled the door open with a flourish, then glanced back at Wax, shaking her head. She obviously thought she was still a blur moving with incredible speed. And she was. Wax had simply joined her. One of the fallen bodies stirred, and Wayne pushed back his hat, showing a grin. Wax raised his hands, a gun in each, and was rewarded by an expression of utter shock on Bleeder's face. She'd regrown her eye, though blood still streamed down the front of her mask. As he had chased her, talked to her, she'd always seemed fully in control. Until this moment. Wax blasted away with both guns. That wasn't usually a good idea, at least if you wanted to hit anything, but they were barely 10 feet apart, and besides, he was inside a speed bubble. His bullets would refract when leaving sped-up time, and so aiming was of questionable value anyway. At a time like this, you didn't want to be precise. You wanted to be thorough. Steris would be proud. He fired in a cacophony, emptying both weapons. He took advantage of Bleeder's shock, dropping his guns and pulling his other Sterian out of its underarm holster and unloading it. His short-barreled shotgun from the holster on his thigh followed, belching slugs and thunder as Wax strode to the edge of the speed bubble. After reaching the rim, the bullets deflected out into normal time, moving painfully slowly. But less than a foot separated Bleeder and the edge of Wayne's bubble. Wax dropped the shotgun and pulled out one of the syringes again, and shoved it toward her, pushing on the metal, hoping against hope that, stunned from the gunfire, she wouldn't notice it coming. As the Condra turned to run, the first bullet hit. Others followed in a storm. Half missed, but Wax had fired almost 24 shots. Many punched into Bleeder, who dropped her ferrochemical speed as they caught her. She moved lethargically, trying to escape the hail of bullets, sprays of blood bursting silently into the air like the seeds blown from a dandelion. She stumbled against the doorframe, and one of the shotgun slugs hit the back of her head, ripping a hole through her face and breaking off the mask. She sagged, gripping the doorframe, draped in her red cloak. The needle flew from Wax's push, spinning in the air, but it, like the bullets, had been deflected by the edge of the speed bubble. It impaled itself into the wood of the doorframe just inches from Bleeder. She righted herself a second later, and sped up again, wounds vanishing. She didn't look at him as her back straightened, and she strode through the door. She did flip the needle off the frame, sending it toppling in slow motion toward the ground. Wax dug a handful of rounds from the pouch on his belt, then leaped out of the speed bubble. He felt an immediate lurch, as if the world had been upended, and heard a faint popping sound. The nausea hit him like a punch to the face, but he was ready for it. He'd ducked out of speed bubbles before. A single gunshot sounded from the safe room. He crossed the distance to the door in a rush, throwing the cartridges in front of himself, ready to push on the ones that he might need to hit Bleeder. Once inside, however, he let the rounds drop to the ground. Bleeder wasn't in the room. An open door at the back led out, presumably through a tunnel to the grounds above. The plush safe room, round and rimmed with bookshelves, had a wet bar on one end and was lit by comfortable reading lamps. The governor knelt on the floor, holding a bleeding Drim, frantically trying to staunch the blood coming from the bodyguard's neck. Wax dashed across the room, stopping at the door into the escape tunnel.
"Lawman!" Innate cried. "Help! Please! Oh, Harmony! Help!"
Wax hesitated, peering into that empty, dark tunnel. He was reminded of another one like it, dusty and shored up by beams at the sides. Both a tomb and a stage. Behind, Wayne stumbled into the room, then scrambled to help Innate. Wax remained by the door into the tunnel, rolling a few rounds between his fingers.
"He saved me,"
Innate said, weeping. By this point he was drenched in Drim's blood. He'd pulled off his shirt, trying to use it to staunch the blood.
"He leaped into the way right as the assassin shot,"
Innate said.
"Tell me you can. Please."
"He's gone, mate," Wayne said, settling back. "Other casualties upstairs, Wayne," Wax said, pointing. With reluctance, he shut the door to the escape tunnel. He couldn't give chase, not and leave the governor alone here. Wayne rushed out of the room to check on the men who had been shot upstairs. Wax walked over to the governor, who knelt before his bodyguard's corpse. He'd never seen Innate look so human as he did at that moment. Shoulders slumped, head bowed. Exhausted. Wrung out. Could anyone fake that? He checked anyway. "Leavening on sand," Wax said. Innate looked up at him, eyes unfocused. Wax's heart skipped a beat, but then the governor sighed.
"Bones without soup."
He knew the passphrase. This was really Innate. Wax knelt beside the governor, looking over Drim's corpse. Annoying though the man had been at times, he had not deserved this. "I'm sorry."
"She stopped moving at a blur,"
Innate said, his voice strained.
"She appeared inside, gone out, but seemed angry about something. Drim leaped for me right before she shot. She was gone a second later. Surely she could have paused to finish me off, rather than running."
"She obtained ferrochemical powers only 2 weeks ago," Wax said. "That time frame greatly limits how much speed she can have stored up, and moving as fast as she has been must have drained her metal mind quickly. She needed to escape before it ran out." Of course, there could be another reason. She might have just wanted to frighten them and the governor, to prod him to do something. But what? She said she intended to kill him, but not until the time was right. Why? What was the plan?
"So, she's flawed," Innate said. "She can be beaten."
"Of course she can," Wax said. He looked down at the corpse, and the floor stained red. But at what cost? He took a deep breath.
"I want you to leave the city."
"No."
"That's stupidity," Wax snapped. "She will be back."
"Have you looked out there, lawman?"
Innate said, waving a bloody hand in a vaguely upward direction.
"Have you seen what's happening in this city?"
"You can't do anything about that tonight."
"I most certainly can,"
Innate stood.
"I'm the leader of this city. I'm not going to run away. If anything, I need to be seen. Need to meet with the chief instigators of this movement, if any can be found. I need to address the crowds, prepare a speech. I need to gather my cabinet and with them make sure that there's still a city here in the morning."
He pointed at Wax.
"You stop this creature, Ladrian. I don't have a bodyguard any longer. I'm in your hands."
He strode out then. Whatever else he thought of the man, Wax had to respect Innate's grit. "You stop this creature." Wax glanced at the syringe still lying on the floor near the doorframe. So close. If it had hit, he might have been able to depress the metal plunger and send the liquid into her veins. Feeling powerless, he fetched that syringe and brought it back to Drim's corpse, dead with a bullet right in the neck. Wax plunged the syringe into the corpse's arm and emptied it into the flesh. Nothing happened. He hadn't expected it to. It seemed very implausible that Bleeder would have managed to get Drim's face on and fool the governor this way. But it still made Wax feel more comfortable. He stumbled to his feet. Rusts, he was tired. Why hadn't she killed the governor? There was more to this. Wayne peeked in.
Two guards might make it. We have a surgeon helping him now.
Good, Wax said. Wait for me upstairs. Wayne nodded, ducking back out. Wax instead walked to the escape route and pulled open the door. He lit a candle and stepped up the slope, cautious, hand on his gun. What did undermining the governor, inciting a riot against the Pathians, and Wax's own freedom have to do with one another? What was he missing? He didn't find Bleeder in the tunnel, though halfway up it he found her red cloak. She'd tossed it, bloodied, to the side. There, scrawled on the wall, was a crude picture shaped like a man, drawn with a fingernail into the wood. Dabs of dried blood marked the figure's eyes, and another marked its mouth. The words scrawled beneath in blood gave Wax a chill. I rip out his tongue to stop the lies. I stab out his eyes to hide from his gaze. You will be free. 17. About a half hour after Bleeder's attack, Wayne walked into the governor's fancy washroom. Only in his head, it wasn't the washroom. He just knew to call it that here. You see, Wayne had figured out the code. Rich folks, they had this code. All of them knew it, and they used it like a new language to weed out everyone who didn't belong. Regular folk, they called something after what it was. You'd say, "What's that, Cal?" And they'd say, "That? That there's the crapper." And you'd reply, "What do you do with it?" And they'd say, "Well, Wayne, that's where you put your crap." It made sense. But rich folk, they had a different word for the crapper. They called it a commode or a washroom. That way, when someone asked for the crapper, they knew it was a person they needed to oppress. Wayne did his business and spat his gum into the bowl before flushing. It felt good to be wearing his own hat again, dueling canes at his waist. He'd spent a good hour or two wearing the clothing and false face of a guard for innate. Horribly uncomfortable, that. He wiped his sniffly nose and washed his hands, drawing them on towels embroidered with innate's name. He was that worried people would run off with his towels? Well, the joke was on him. Wayne was perfectly happy to wipe up dirt with the governor's name. He tucked the towel into his pocket and left in trade a few mints he'd taken from the bar. He wandered out from there, peeking into the room where the governor was holding a meeting with all kinds of important folks, the type who called the crapper the facilities. You know, he thought, maybe I'll have it wrong. Maybe it's not code. Maybe they're just so familiar with what comes out of their arses, normal words aren't specific enough. Like how the terrace language had 7 different words for iron. He nodded to himself. A new theory. Wax was going to love this one. Wayne passed into the room with the couches where the guards had been gunned down. Wax stood inside with an envelope into which he dropped something small and metallic. He sealed it, then handed it to a young messenger from the governor's staff.
Deliver it quickly, Wax said. Pound on the door. Wake her up if you have to. And don't get scared off if she cusses at you or threatens to shoot you. She won't actually hurt you.
The young man nodded, though he'd gone pale.
Tell her it's urgent, Wax said, holding up his finger. Don't let her toss it aside and read it in the morning. You stay there until she's read what I wrote, you understand?
Yes, sir.
Good lad. Off with you.
The youth ran out. Wayne strolled over to Wax, passing the open door down to the safe room. The bodies around it had been removed, though the blood remained.
Renette?
Wayne asked hopefully. Wax nodded.
I thought of something that might help.
I could have delivered that, you know.
You, she would shoot, Wax said.
Only 'cause she likes me, Wayne said, smiling.
He'd have welcomed an excuse to go see Renette. This night was getting darker and darker, it seemed.
Wayne, Wax said, you know she doesn't actually like you.
You always say that. But you're just not seeing the truth, Wax.
She tries to kill you.
To keep me alive, Wayne said. She knows I live a dangerous life. So, keeping me on my toes is the best way to make sure I stick around.
Anyway, was that Maracy I saw in there with the governor and his important folk?
Wax nodded.
She and Milan arrived a short time back. Ardell wants to declare martial law.
And you don't?
Wayne asked, taking a seat on one of the nice couches that didn't have much blood splattered on it.
Important people were meeting nearby. He suspected he knew what would come next, and he intended to wait around for it.
Wax stood for a moment, then shook his head.
Bleeder set this all up, Wayne. She's been pushing us toward this. I rip out his tongue, I stab out his eyes.
Now, I'm as for dismemberment as the next fellow, Wayne said. But that's a mite violent for this time of day.
Bleeder wrote it on the wall down below. A poem of some sort. It doesn't feel finished to me.
She nailed that priest through the eyes, Wayne noted.
And ripped out Winston's tongue, Wax said.
He fished in his pocket and brought something out, tossing it to Wayne.
What's this?
Wayne asked, turning it over in his fingers. It was a piece of painted wood.
Remains of the marksman's mask. Bleeder was wearing it.
You think she was him all along? Wayne asked.
Maybe, Wax said. It would have served her purpose, riling up the people of the slums, reminding them how rich the houses are. By bringing him down, I put myself at odds with the common people.
I hate to say it, mate, Wayne said, but you ain't exactly beloved of them anyway.
I'm a hero from the roughs, Wax said.
You're a conner, Wayne said. And a house lord, mate. Not to mention the fact that you can, you know, fly. You can't treat this like weathering. You can't convince a fellow you're on his side by slapping him in jail overnight, then playing cards with him until he sees you as a regular chap.
Wax sighed.
You're right, of course.
Usually am,
except that time on Lessie's birthday.
You always have to bring that up, don't you?
Wayne leaned back, tipping his hat down over his eyes.
Honest mistake.
You put dynamite in the oven, Wayne.
Gotta hide a gift where nobody'll look for it.
I need to piece this together, Wax said, starting to pace. Sketch it out, write it down. We're missing something very important.
Wayne nodded, but was hardly listening.
Wax would figure it out.
Wayne just needed to get some shut-eye while the getting was still good enough for. He heard a door click open. He threw back his hat and was on his feet a second later, scrambling for the door. Wax cursed, pulling out one of his guns, following as Wayne dashed into the hallway and intercepted the servant with a plate full of little party foods.
Aha!
Wayne said.
Thought you could slip by me, did you?
The kitchen maid looked horrified as Wayne gathered up three of each of the treats. Wax stopped in the doorway, then lowered his gun.
Oh, for Harmony's sake! Harmony can get his own,
Wayne said, popping a little cake in his mouth. As he turned back to Wax, the maid scuttled away, heading for the meeting. It was exactly what Wayne had been waiting for. Important folk meeting together always meant snacks. Or canapes, if you knew the code. Wayne popped one in his mouth, candied bacon wrapped around a walnut.
How is it? Wax asked.
Tastes like cotton candy,
Wayne said, relishing the flavor.
Made of baby.
I did not need to hear that, Wax said, slipping his gun back into its holster. I'm going to need to go back out there, see if I can figure out Bleeder's plan. That leaves you here to protect the governor again.
Wayne nodded.
I'll do what I can, but that's a tall order, mate.
I've arranged for some help, Wax said, leading the way over to the lady's crapper. He knocked on the door.
Still changing,
Milan's voice came from inside.
How long?
Wax said. The door cracked and a woman's face peeked out that looked completely unlike Milan's.
Not long,
she said in Milan's voice.
This lady's hair was a real pain.
She shut the door.
I recognize that face,
Wayne said, folding his arms and leaning against the wall.
One of the guards, Wax said, that got shot a little earlier.
Oh, right,
Wayne had a sinking feeling.
Wasn't she one of the ones I tried to save?
Died shortly thereafter,
Wax said. Milan will keep the arm in a sling. That was where the shot hit first, before penetrating into the woman's lung. We'll keep her on the governor's guard staff, and hopefully Bleeder will be so busy looking for you and me that she'll miss Milan.
I hope you appreciate this,
the Chandra's voice came from inside the crapper.
I hate being short. As a side note, this lady tasted awful. Far too lean and tough.
The door cracked, revealing the face again.
Next time, choose a body that's been sitting around a while, would you? Nice and aged is the best flavor for...
She trailed off, looking from Wayne to Wax, noticing their expressions.
Oh, right, she said. Mortals, I'd forgotten how squeamish you can be.
Please, Wax said, sounding pained. Show some respect for the dead woman. It's already difficult to let you use her corpse like this. Milan rolled her eyes. Rusts, it was strange to see her behave just like before, but in an entirely different body.
It's either me or the worms, kids. Don't you think she'd be happy to go out all at once, munched down in half an hour, rather than sitting there and melting into the ground over the course of...
Too much description, Milan, Wax said, his voice strained.
Fine, fine. I'm almost ready. Just have to get the clothing on. How is the hair?
Good, Wayne said. I think you've forgotten eyebrow, though. Milan felt at her face.
Hell, she said. This is what you get by forcing me to work so quickly.
She ducked back into the room. Speaking of quickly, Wax said through the door, is this about what I can expect with Bleeder? A half hour to change bodies? Wayne nodded. That would be useful to know.
No, unfortunately,
Milan's voice said from inside, muffled. It was still the same voice as she'd had in her other body. Was she going to change that?
Ba'alm is old generation. Very practiced. I don't think anybody is as good as Tensun, mind you. But Ba'alm will be fast, particularly swapping into a body she's used before. I've known early generationers who can change bodies in under 10 minutes, and that's going in blind.
Isn't that tough? Wayne called. Like, I once had to eat 20 sausages for a bet. Won 5 notes, but spent an hour on the ground moaning like a fellow on the pot trying to force a mango through his delicate donut, if you catch my meaning. Wax groaned softly, but a short time later, Milan opened the door again, and was this time clothed in a black suit like the other guards. She was also smiling.
You're cute,
she noted to Wayne.
How's my eyebrow?
Good. Cute? But I'm taken.
In answer to your question, Milan said, it is hard, but not for the reason you're implying. We can force-feed and expel excess, which makes doing the transformation near a drain like in here convenient. The tough part is memorizing the muscle patterns as you digest them. That, and getting the hair right. You people are practically drowning in the stuff. Fortunately, for a quick change like this, I can ignore the hair under the clothing.
So, wait, Wayne said, rubbing his chin. You're saying we might be able to check if a person is a Chandra by...
Seeing if they put leg and arm hair on?
Milan asked.
That might actually work, but only if the Chandra had to change fast.
Arm hair, Wayne said. Right. I was thinking of arm hair.
That is the most difficult part to get right on short notice, Milan said. We can't make hair, so we've got to use your own, and place each strand in a pore. Arms and legs have thousands of things. What a pain. Far worse than a mass on the head or whatnot.
Milan, Wax said, digging in his coat pocket and bringing something out. Do you recognize this?
I don't have a lot to go on, Chief, but I'd say it's an empty glass vial.
Take it inside and turn off the lights, Wax said, tossing her the vial as Wayne stepped forward trying to get a look. That stuff seemed interesting. Milan withdrew, then shoved open the door a second later. She grabbed Wax by the mist coat, somehow still imposing despite the fact that she was now shorter than either of them.
Where did you get this?
Bottom of Bleeder's robes, Wax said. The ones she was wearing to imitate a priest.
This is Perchwither, Milan said. It's a bioluminescent fungus. It grows only in one place.
Where? Wax asked.
The Chondra homeland.
Wax looked deflated. Oh, so that's where we'd expect her to be going, right?
No,
Milan said.
The Chondra are no longer trapped there. We move in society. We have homes, lives. If we want to meet up with others of our kind, we catch them at the pub. The homeland is a monument, a holy site, a place of relics. The fact that she's been there recently, wearing the body of someone she killed...
Milan shivered visibly, letting go of Wax.
It's nauseating.
I should check it out, Wax said. She might be staying down there. Milan folded her arms, looking him over.
Harmony says it's okay, she said. You can get in through the tombs. Look for the sign of Atium, and use your other eyes. We don't use that entrance very often, but it's probably easiest for you. Just don't break anything, lawman.
I'll do my best, Wax said, turning as a footman peeked in from the hallway, then approached with a small silver tray bearing a card.
Lord Ladrian,
said the footman, holding out the tray.
Your coach has arrived.
Coach? Wayne asked. On a hunt, Wax was usually in full-on fly-through-the-city-like-a-rusting-vulture mode. Why would he need a coach? Wax picked up the card on the tray, then nodded and took a deep breath. Thank you. He turned to Wayne and Milan. Keep the governor alive. I'll send word if I discover anything.
So what's in the coach? Wayne asked.
I sent a note soon after I got here to the mansion, Wax said. There's one person in this city who might have an inkling of what Bleeder is up to. Wax's face took on a grim cast.
Ah, of course, Wayne thought.
He patted Wax on the shoulder. This wouldn't be a pleasant meeting.
Who?
Milan asked, looking from Wayne back to Wax.
What are you talking about?
Have you ever heard, Wax said, of a group called the Set? Wax found his uncle waiting comfortably inside the coach. No bodyguards. The coachman didn't even ask for Wax's weapons as he stopped at the door. Contacting his uncle had been easy. The appointment book had listed a few of Ed Warren's safe deposit boxes, kept under false names. After posting watch on one for a few weeks, Wax had found a letter inside, suggesting he try something else. He'd left his own letter. After that, one had appeared for him. They never said anything useful, and Wax had driven himself crazy trying to find out how they were being placed. But Ed Warren seemed to know the moment a new one from Wax arrived. Wax took a deep breath, then climbed into the coach. Ed Warren was a stocky man, distinguished by a short, precisely trimmed beard, a beautifully tailored suit, and a cravat so narrow and thin it lay flat like a bow tie loosened at the end of a long night. Ed Warren's hands rested easily on the ornate head of a cane, and his face bore a wide smile.
"Nephew,"
he said as Wax settled into his seat.
"You can't imagine my joy upon receiving your note, and with a promise that you wouldn't try to arrest me. So quaint. I came immediately. I feel like we've been too distant lately."
"Distant? You tried to have me killed."
"And you've tried to return the favor,"
Ed Warren said, knocking with his cane on the roof to get the coach moving.
"Yet here we sit, both alive and well. I see no reason why we can't be amiable. We are rivals, yes, but also still family."
"You're a criminal, uncle," Wax said. "Considering the things you've done, I don't feel much familial empathy." Ed Warren sighed, slipping his pipe from his pocket.
"Can't you at least try to be pleasant?"
"I'll try." Truth was, Wax wanted information from this man. Antagonizing him would not be smart. They rolled on silently for a while as Ed Warren lit the pipe and Wax tried to organize his thoughts. How to approach this?
"Dangerous night,"
Ed Warren noted, nodding out the window as they passed a group of men and women holding aloft lanterns and torches while listening to a woman standing on a stack of boxes. She shouted into the mists angry words that Wax couldn't quite make out. Rusts, that group was close to the governor's mansion. He hoped that Innate and the constables could get this under control.
I wonder, Ed Warren said, puffing on his pipe, if that night long ago felt the same as this one. The night when the survivor's gambit played out. The fall of a regime. The start of a new world.
You can't possibly think this is equivalent, Wax said. The Lord Ruler's reign was one of terror and oppression. These people are upset, yes, but it's a far different world now.
Different, Ed Warren said, letting smoke roll from his mouth as he spoke. Perhaps. But human emotions are the same. It seems that no matter how nice the box is, put a man inside it and he will buck. Fight.
Rail.
And you claim to be on the side of the common man, Wax said dryly.
Hardly. I want power, wealth, influence. Just like the people in the Survivor's crew, actually.
They were heroes.
And thieves.
They were what they had to be.
And Kelsier himself, Ed Warren said. In the years before his grand gambit. What of the Ascendant Warrior, living on the street, scamming noblemen and priests for a living? Have you read the words of Founding, nephew? The Historica speaks frankly about their ambitions. A survivor didn't just want to overthrow the Lord Ruler. He wanted to steal the Empire's riches. He wanted to rule the world that came about upon the Lord Ruler's fall.
He wanted power, influence, wealth.
I'm not going down this road, Uncle, Wax said.
Have you ever wondered, Ed Warren mused, ignoring Wax's objection, if you'd get along with them? If you'd lived back then, what would you have seen? A bunch of miscreants? Lawbreakers? Would you have trussed up the Ascendant Warrior and tossed her in a cell? The law is not something holy, son. It's just a reflection of the ideals of those lucky enough to be in charge.
I don't know any constables, Wax said, who think the law is perfect or the courts infallible. But they're the best damn things we have right now, and I'm not going to entertain for a second the idea that you're some kind of secret seeker of justice. You're as rotten as they come, Uncle.
So pleasant, Ed Warren said. And this is what I get for responding to your invitation. Insults and vitriol, and one wonders why our house is considered a laughingstock these days. I'm told they invite you to parties just to see you strut.
I sent to you, Wax said through clenched teeth, because I think we might have a common enemy. I know you want to rule this city. Well, I need you to see reason. I've spoken with the creature. If we don't stop her, there might not be a city to rule. Ed Warren didn't respond, holding his pipe and looking through the coach's glass window at the curling mists in the darkness just outside. What do you know? Wax asked, almost a plea. I'm certain the set has been watching events with interest. Your attempt to kill me earlier. Tell me that was just a strike of opportunity. Tell me you weren't working with her. She'll see it all burn, Uncle. Help me bring her down. Ed Warren mused silently a while, enjoying his pipe.
Do you realize what your overzealous campaign against us has accomplished, nephew? He finally asked. Half the city's elements are too frightened to work with the set for fear that you'll show up on their doorstep and shoot their mothers. The money you've seized hasn't ruined us, but it has made some of our members very, very upset.
Good. Wax said.
You say that because you're ignorant, Ed Warren spat. Among the members of the set, I am conservative. I speak against brashness, against violence. The more you shove, however, the weaker my influence becomes, and stronger grow the voices clamoring for change. At any cost.
Oh, Harmony, Wax whispered. You are working with her.
It's more like we are riding the storm, Ed Warren said. Personally, I'd love to see you bring this creature down. It might topple some of my rivals, give me a chance to propose something audacious of my own to the set.
But I'm not going to help you, nephew. Perhaps this is what needs to be.
How can you do this? Wax asked. You're going to watch it all burn?
Ashes are excellent fertilizer, Edwin said. Unless they pile so high they smother everything.
Edwin drew his lips to a tight line. You are short-sighted and self-righteous. You were ever so, even during your youth. But still, I love you, nephew. I consider it a sign of that love that I haven't actually had you killed. I keep hoping you'll see we are not your enemy. We are the thieves and miscreants of this day who will someday be hailed as heroes. The men and women who will change the world because... What was it you said? This is what we need to be in order to survive.
And my sister, Wax said,
is holding her captive part of what you need to do to survive?
Yes, actually, Edwin said, meeting his eyes.
Because I don't doubt that someday I'm going to need to use her against you. Kill me, and your sister is as good as dead, Waxelium.
He knocked again on the ceiling beneath the driver. The carriage slowed to a stop.
Run along now, Edwin said. Go be the toy soldier and pretend you wouldn't have murdered the survivor's entire crew if you'd lived under the Lord Ruler. Try to pretend you went out into the roughs to find justice, and not because you realized life in this city was just too damn hard for you.
They sat in the quiet, immobile coach. Wax held himself steady, though Edwin's eyes flicked toward Wax's shoulder holster as if he was expecting Wax to draw. He could. He could shoot this man right here and now. He'd broken promises before, and to far better men than his uncle.
Kill me and your sister is as good as dead.
Wax kicked the door open.
I'm going to go deal with this Chandra, but know that I won't forget you, uncle. One day you're going to find me standing behind you with a gun to your head, and you'll have the sudden, horrible realization that there's nothing left that can protect you.
I look forward to it, Edwin said. If that day doesn't come before next summer, you should join me for Meriwether dinner. We'll have stuffed pig in your honor.
Wax growled softly, but stepped from the coach and slammed the door. 18. Marcy had spent a great portion of her adult life preparing to be an attorney, and her mother had wished her to someday find her way to politics. Marcy had abandoned aspirations toward politics in her youth, and had recently abandoned the solicitors as well. The thing was, those professions had one important flaw. They were populated entirely with attorneys and politicians. Despite her best efforts, she now found herself in a room full of them. Governor Innate stood by the hearth here, in his private study, one arm resting on the mantel. Arrayed before him were the men and women of his executive staff, a hearty bunch who didn't seem nearly as groggy as the constables and guards who had been called up in the middle of the night. In fact, the group displayed a distinct energy as they discussed the crisis. Their words tumbled over one another in their eagerness to express their opinions, like children vying for parental approval. Marcy stood beside the window, where the governor had put her, saying he'd get to her later. So she waited, listened, and circumspectly took notes on her pad. If the Chandra happened to be hiding among them, she doubted a verbal slip would enable her to recognize Bleeder, but it seemed the best use of her time as long as she was required to stay put.
"It will all blow over," repeated the city sanitation director. He was an attorney who had been through the same program she'd completed, albeit many years ago.
Marcy wasn't sure why he needed a law degree to run city sanitation.
"Rep, you're taking this too seriously."
"I am taking an attempt on my life too seriously?"
Innate asked.
"An attack that left one of my lifelong friends dead?"
That brought a stillness to the room, and the sanitation director settled back down, red-faced. Innate had changed his shirt from the one stained red with blood, but Marcy knew they all had seen him before he'd done so. She rather thought he'd delayed changing until they had.
"I wasn't talking about the assassination attempt," the sanitation director said. "I meant the ruckus outside. It will blow over."
"They're already looting,"
the Minister of Trade noted, a bespectacled woman who had brought two aides to take notes for her. She hadn't offered them seats. "There will always be looting," the sanitation director said. "It happens. We hunker down, let burn what needs to burn. Contain rather than try to stamp out."
"Foolishness,"
said the Secretary of Education, a corpulent woman who sat with her feet up by the crackling fire.
"This is a time for decisiveness, my lord. You need to show your rivals that you are not easily cowed. You know the Lacalls have been getting traction lately, and your brother's scandal will only fuel their ambition. Mark my words, they will present a strong candidate to rival you at the next election, and he will lean on this night's events to discredit you."
"Yes," said the Minister of Public Affairs. "Could they be behind the assassination attempt, perhaps?" The governor glanced toward Marcy, the first time he'd acknowledged her since the meeting had begun. He knew about Milan now. She'd shown her true nature to him just before the meeting started. He believed, and had begun by explaining to the executive staff about the rogue Condra. The others obviously considered it foolishness and, after the way of their kind, were simply ignoring what he'd told them. Marcy met his gaze calmly. Once upon a time she had dreamed of being a participant in meetings like this one. Gatherings where important decisions were made, where laws were drafted and political strategies adopted. Now she found herself frustrated by all the talk. Waxillium was rubbing off on her, and perhaps not in ways she should appreciate.
Now, the sanitation director said. "The Lacalls aren't behind this. An assassin? Are you mad, Daunton? They would never be caught engaging in something so potentially damaging."
"Agreed," said the Secretary of Education. "This was someone far more desperate. I repeat, my Lord Governor, decisiveness, leadership. You asked about martial law. Well, that is the minimum you must do, I say. Send the constables out in force. Crush the looters. Scatter the rioters. Be seen protecting the city."
Others voiced their opinions on this, and the governor quieted them.
I'll consider.
His tone was sharp, sharper than Maris he had heard from him before.
"Out with you all. I need to think."
In that moment, he looked haggard. The counselors quieted, then made their way out. Marcy moved to join them, reluctantly.
"Miss Colmes,"
the governor said, walking to his desk.
"A moment."
Marcy obeyed, stepping up before the desk as he settled down. He reached to the floor, pushing back the rug and exposing the top of a small safe, which he absently unlocked with a key from his desk. He reached inside, taking out his seal of office, then settled down to begin writing.
"Tell Constable General Oradell that he has his writ of martial law," the governor said tiredly. "He's the only constable general to contact me so far, which I find disturbing. I am appointing him with executive authority as Lord High Constable, director of all law enforcement offices in the city until this crisis is over. The other Octon's constable generals will need to report to him."
Marcy didn't reply. The others weren't going to like that. The rivalry among the Octant precincts was officially characterized as friendly, but in reality had far too much bite to it for her taste.
"And your instructions regarding the people of the city?" Marcy asked softly as he wrote. "Should the constables do as your education secretary suggests?"
Innate finished writing. He looked up at her and seemed to weigh her with his eyes.
"You're new to the constabulary, I believe. The cousin of Lord Ladrian's betrothed?"
"I wasn't aware I had attracted your attention," Marcy said.
"You haven't. He has. Damnable man."
Marcy remained silent, feeling awkward before his judgmental gaze.
"Those mobs will end up here sooner or later, you know," the governor said, tapping his pen on the table. "They'll come demanding answers. I must speak to them. Turn this tide."
"Speak to them?" Marcy thought. "As you did earlier?" That speech hadn't shown any particular sense of empathy. Rusts, had that only been this afternoon? Checking the governor's ornate desk clock, she found it was almost 2. So the governor's speech had technically been yesterday. She probably shouldn't have looked at the time. Seeing exactly how late it was merely reminded her of her own exhaustion. It was like an angry creditor pounding on her door. she'd be able to ignore it for only so long.
Tell Aradel, the governor mused, not to stop the people from converging here at the mansion, but he is to beat down any looters in other parts of the city. Put the fear of the sword into them. I'll need a force of constables here, of course, to keep the masses who come to me in check, but I do want to speak to them. This will be a night for history to be made.
Sir, Marcy said, I know a thing or two about the mentality of crowds. If you wish... Someone outside called for Nate, and he stood in the middle of Marcy's sentence. He shoved the writ toward her, sealed with his stamp, then marched out to deal with the questions. Marcy watched him go with a sigh. Hopefully Wayne and that Condra woman would be able to assure his safety. She'd happily see Innate incarcerated someday, but she didn't wish him dead. His assassination would be, among other things, terrible for city morale. She stored the writ beside her pistol in her purse, then walked from the room and slipped through the hallway where many of the cabinet members were giving orders to aides and accepting cups of steaming black tea from household staff. Wayne lounged in a corner, feet up on an end table and spinning an expensive golden mahogany pen between his fingers. Harmony knew where he'd stolen that. Unfortunately, her motor needed a refueling, so she'd have to use more mundane methods to run the writ to Aradel. She found the footman and ordered a carriage. The haggard footman, however, shook his head.
It will be a few minutes, miss, before I can dredge up a coach. The executive staff have half the cabs in the city running notes for them, and on a night like this one, no less.
He glanced meaningfully toward the open door. Outside, the porch lights barely penetrated the mists. They curled and danced, almost timid. Tiny wisps would creep into the entry hall, then vanish almost immediately like steam over a stove.
I will wait, Marcy said. Thank you.
He seemed pleased by her response. Perhaps others had been less understanding. As he was called away, Marcy idled in the doorway, staring into the mists. That orange haze over the city wasn't normal. Fires were burning out there. If they were lucky, those flames would only be massed lanterns and torches, not buildings. Standing there strongly reminded her of something that she couldn't put her finger on. She shook her head and walked back into the mansion with a half-mind to find Wayne and see what he thought of recent events. In the large sitting room, beyond the entryway, she passed a weary serving man scrubbing the wooden floor. The bloodstains were stubborn, it appeared. The man had already discreetly rolled the rug up against the wall for disposal. Marcy passed him and, changing her mind about finding Wayne, instead walked down the stairs toward the hidden chamber.
A city close to breaking, she thought as she reached the bottom. This has happened before.
In the confined space, the air still smelled of the soap that had been used to clean up the blood. The empty safe room had a quiet, scholastic feel about it, with all those books on the walls. There was no overhead lighting, just the lamps shaded a soft red-orange. She walked around the room, noting the many volumes of the Full Words of Founding when she passed it on the wall. The leather-bound books seemed pristine, and, on a whim, she pulled the first one out and checked it. The pages were uncut, as sometimes happened in new books. This volume had obviously never been read. Long ago, the survivor had pushed a city to the brink of destruction, then channeled that fury into a rebellion that had overthrown a millennium-long dictatorship. Every student learned of those days, but Marcy had read the detailed accounts, including of the night when it had all come to a head. She could imagine it had been a night very much like this one. Only instead of the survivor, this time it had been induced by a psychotic murderer.
She has to be doing it on purpose, Marcy thought, walking through the room. Trying to echo that night when the Lord Ruler fell. A people on the brink of insurrection. Noble houses at each other's throats. And now...
Now a speech. The governor would have his moment before the crowd, and they would sense the resonance, even if they couldn't put their finger on it. They'd been taught about that night since childhood. They would listen to him and expect him to be like the last emperor who had spoken long ago on the night of the Lord Ruler's death. The last emperor had come to power because of his heartfelt words that night. But Governor Innate was not Elend Venture. Far from it. Maracy suddenly stopped and backed up a few steps. She'd been walking beside the built-in bookcases, paying little conscious attention to them, but just enough to have noticed something off. Here, on this long shelf of pristine books, were three in a row with spines scuffed at the bottom. What distinguished these books? They were part of a 7-volume collection of dry political treatises written long ago by the Counselor of Gods. She took one and flipped through it, finding nothing of interest. Perhaps Innate had been studying lately. But why were only the 3rd, 4th, and 5th volumes scuffed? She picked up another and opened it, and here she found the reason. Cut into the center of the pages was a hole containing a key. Innate hadn't been reading Breeze's old essays. He had simply forgotten which volume had the key in it. Maracy held up the key, then glanced at the room's solitary desk. Dared she?
Of course I dare,
she thought, crossing the room with a swish of skirts. Her constable credentials, plus Aradel's concern about the governor, would give her legal grounds for doing a quick search. She knew the law as well as anyone. She also knew that the law was subject to interpretation by the city's judges, most of whom had noble blood and would not take kindly to someone spying on the governor. That was why her fingers were trembling as she quickly tried the key in the desk drawer. It didn't fit. She paused, then tried a spot on the floor like the one up above, where the governor had gotten out his seal. Sure enough, there was a hidden safe under the rug. She turned the key in it and earned a satisfying click. She pulled the safe open and quickly scanned the contents. A pistol. Cigars, she didn't recognize the brand. A bundle of banknotes tied with string, enough to buy a house. Maracy's eyes bulged a little, but she kept searching. A stack of letters. These she took over to the desk, expecting to find details of an illicit romantic relationship or the like. She skimmed them, then read more deeply, then sank down into the desk's chair, raising her fingers to her lips. The letters did detail a relationship, or rather, many of them. These were private communications with house leaders throughout the city. Although couched in euphemism and circumlocution, to her they clearly spoke of corruption. Maracy grew cold as she flipped through them letter by letter. The actual writing was opaque. We agree that certain courtesies will be extended, or these are acceptable terms as per our previous arrangement. But they were dated, and her mind quickly related each of them to her notes back at the precinct. This was proof. She flipped through more. Yes, they aligned with her own statistical analysis. These were Innate's promises of political favors in exchange for bribes. With obfuscatory language, it might not be a smoking gun, but it was at least a very warm one. Better, Innate had added notations to most of the letters to remind himself of important points. Here was one, probably trading a promise by Innate to push for higher tariffs on refined steel from outside the city, in exchange for a favorable deal on a land purchase by one of his family. Another more recent one was about a judge's seat, when Innate had appointed a Hammondess scion to a recent opening. She'd suspected corruption, but this was jarring, seeing it discussed like this in black and white. She sifted through the stack. No letters to the Lacals, his primary rivals. None to Waxillium, either, Maracy saw with relief. Nor any older ones to Edworn Ladrian, Waxillium's uncle. Under the letters was a ledger which she expected would show what Innate thought he was still owed, and would also record the state of his private accounts. Flipping through quickly didn't tell her enough to be certain, but it did seem reasonable. Maracy sat holding it all, feeling overwhelmed. Rusts. The people are right to be in revolt. Was this the crux of Bleeder's plan? Shove Innate into the limelight, then undermine him by exposing his corruption? Indeed, the corrupt nature of virtually every noble family in the city? In revealing these letters, Maracy could be playing into the creature's hands. That made her sick. If he was this corrupt, didn't he need to be exposed and removed? She hurriedly tucked the letters into her purse. Captain Aradel needed to see this. Maracy quickly shut and locked the safe, put back the key, and then started up the steps. She didn't want to be in the basement when the footman came looking for her to announce her carriage. Innate will claim they were planted by Bleeder, Maracy thought as she reached ground level. He'll have an easy out. Beyond that, if he noticed they were gone, he'd have a pretty good idea of who took them. That same servant was still cleaning up, and he'd seen Marcy go down and return. But rust and ruin. She wasn't going to just ignore something like this. Flying through the air at night let Wax see the distinct presence of humankind as marked by strict boundaries. Where they dwelled, there was illumination, pinpricks in the darkness, men and women sticking a claim on the night. The lights spread like the roots of a tree. His uncle had left him far from where he wanted to be. Fortunately, for a coin shot, even the vastness of Ellendale was manageable. He didn't immediately turn inward, however, to visit the Chondra homeland. His uncle's words haunted him, and before those, Bleeder's jibes. They attacked from two different directions, like pins pushed into either temple. He needed to think, to be alone. Perhaps then he could sort through what this mess meant. He landed on a rooftop overlooking the vast, glowing carpet of lights before him. A cat watched him from a nearby flower box, its eyes alight. Below was another row of pubs. Loud, raucous. Surely it was past 2 in the morning, yet they showed no signs of quieting down. Rusts, how he hated that one could never feel truly alone in the city. Even in the privacy of his mansion, the quiet was marred by the incessant passage of carriages outside. He leaped away into the night, frightening the cat. He soared high in a long arc, trying to get far enough away that he couldn't hear the men shouting drunkenly in the row of pubs. His search took him eastward toward the edge of the city. As he approached, something emerged from the mists, like the bleached spine of some ancient monster. Eastbridge, a massive construction that spanned the Iron Gate River here. On one hand, he marveled that humankind could create something like this, an enormous, riveted marvel, big enough to let motors pass and also hold railroad tracks. On the other hand, the mists completely engulfed the bridge, giving it an even more skeletal cast. Humankind would create and take pride in those creations, but Harmony's presence could make it all seem trivial. Did he know? Wax landed atop one of the bridge's towers, boots clanging. Could he have saved Lessie? The answer was simple. Of course Harmony had known. To believe in a god was to accept that he or she wasn't going to deliver you from every problem. It wasn't something Wax had ever dwelled on. Living in the roughs, he'd accepted that sometimes you just had to weather things on your own. Help didn't always come. That was life. You dealt with it. But now, something felt different. He'd spoken to Harmony. Hell, Wax was out here right now because of a request from God himself. That made it all the more personal. God hadn't saved Lessie, hadn't given Wax warning. And now he expected Wax to just hop to it and do as he demanded? And what would you do? Wax addressed himself, walking along the bridge's lofty pinnacle. Let the city burn? Let Bleeder keep killing? Of course he couldn't. Harmony knew that too. He had Wax by the throat. Are you there? Wax asked, sending the thought out. Harmony? He felt at his ear before remembering he'd taken out his earring. By necessity, yes, but in that moment he was glad not to have it. Not to let God get a purchase on his mind, for the thoughts he had weren't particularly pious. Wax strode through the mists, while down below a lone motor car puttered across the bridge. Bleeder was toying with him. He could feel her fingers sneaking in, piercing his skull, wrapping around his mind. He could see exactly what she was doing, yet couldn't banish the questions she raised. Wax paused at one end of the tower's top. From here, he could see the edge of the city, where the lights gave way to the darkness of the countryside. Behind him, the city was a brilliant blaze, thousands upon thousands of lights, but the electric lines hadn't yet come out past the bridge. On the outskirts of Ellendale, the lights stopped. The last few hung on the bridge, like lighthouses looking out at the vast blackness of the sea. He yearned for that darkness, to leap out into it, escape all this responsibility, stop needing to worry about hundreds of thousands of people he couldn't know, and get back to helping the few he could. Freedom. Freedom to Wax wasn't the absence of responsibility. He didn't doubt that if he left again, he'd find himself as a lawman once more. No. Freedom was not lack of responsibilities. It was being able to do what was right without having to worry if it was also wrong. He didn't contemplate leaving, not seriously. But he did sit for a time looking out at that darkness, trying to look past the people, the shadowed suburbs, and see simplicity again. Rusts. What he wouldn't give to trade all the politicians' games and secrets for an honest murderer calling him out on the street. Coward. His own thought. Not from Harmony or Bleeder. That made it all the more like a punch to the gut, for he knew it to be the truth. Wax took a deep breath and stood up again, shouldering his burdens. He turned away from the darkness and leapt off the bridge, pushing himself into the night again. He'd come here for a moment's solace, to think. Turned out, he didn't like where those thoughts were taking him. 19. As much as Wayne appreciated all the fancy treats the governor was providing, he had to admit he wasn't entirely sympathetic to the man's plight. After all, the whole point of having someone in charge, like the governor, was about making sure people knew which fellow to kill. That was why they had elections, wasn't it? And he'd got to be in charge and order everybody about. But when the assassins got bored, they didn't go whack the guy what sold fish on the street corner. They went for the guy in charge. You had to take the good with the bad, you did. On one hand, you got fancy sweets any time of day. On the other hand, you might find murderers in your loo. That was the breaks. And this innate guy, he seemed to really want to meet Iron Eyes. Not running away to the country when you knew a psychopathic shape-shifting super-alamancer was after you? Yeah, he understood he was a target. As Wayne sauntered after him, taking the tray from the serving girl as she tried to retreat with the uneaten cakes, the governor stopped in the doorway to his study.
"I need a few minutes to think, to prepare my remarks," he said to Wayne and the other guards. "Thank you."
"But sir," Milan said, "you can't go in alone. We need to protect you."
"And what are any of you going to do," Innate said, "about someone who can move at the speed of a thunderclap? We'll just have to take our chances that the constables can deal with this creature."
"I don't think—"
Milan began, but cut off as he shut the door, leaving her, Wayne, and a couple of other guards in the hallway. Wayne rolled his eyes, then leaned against the wall.
"You two," he said to the other guards, "go watch the window from outside that room, why don't you? We'll sit up here."
The two fellows shuffled, looked like they'd object, but then slunk out of the hallway. "I wonder," Wayne thought, settling down on the floor beside the door, "if they're rethinking their career choices. What with most everyone else guarding the governor dead already."
"You mortals," Milan said, waving toward the door, "can be surprisingly cavalier with your limited lifespans."
"Yeah," Wayne said. "He probably just wants to get me in trouble."
"What?"
Milan sounded amused.
"By getting himself killed?"
"Sure," Wayne said. "The idiot forbade me from going to his fancy party earlier, then ditched me afterwise. He's got it in for me. He's going to get himself killed and leave me to explain it to Wax. Sorry, mate, I'll let your pet politician get ripped in half, and Wax'll scowl at me real good, even though it's not my fault."
Milan sat down across from him and grinned.
"Is that what happened to his horse?"
"Why you gotta bring up that again?" Wayne asked, wriggling down to get comfortable and tipping his hat over his eyes. "That really wasn't my fault. I had myself a debilitating injury when that happened." "Yeah," Wayne said. "Made me cuss and drink like a bugger."
He settled back, listening, eyes closed. Servants moved through the building. Messengers went over their routes. Important types discussed their opinions just a room over. They all talked. Everyone had to talk. People couldn't just think something, they had to explain it. Wayne was the same. He was people, after all. This murderer, this Condra, she was people too. She had talked to Wax. She had to talk. Wax would probably catch her. He did things like that. Impossible things that nobody thought he could. But just in case he didn't, Wayne listened. You could tell a lot about people from the way they talked. You saw their past, their upbringing, their aspirations, all in the words they used. And this Chandra, sooner or later she'd slip up and use the wrong word, a word that would be obvious, like a fellow drinking milk in the middle of a rowdy tavern. He didn't hear anything right off, though oddly he did notice Milan whispering to herself. As he listened, she modulated her voice, making it deeper, though still feminine. She repeated a few words to herself. "She would have been a toofy," Wayne noted, eyes still closed.
"Hmm?"
Milan said. "Your bones," Wayne said. "Woman you're wearing right now. Toofy. Second octant. Raised on the outskirts."
"And how do you know that?"
Milan asked. "Heard her curse as I was helping her," Wayne said, feeling a stab of regret. The woman had just been doing her job, trying to keep someone from being killed. "She's still doing her job, though," he thought, cracking an eye and looking at Milan. "Her bones are, at least." Given the choice, if he died while trying to do something important, he'd rather that his bones get up and see it done right. Hell, with some Chandra friends, he could be annoying Steris well into the afterlife.
"Like this," Milan said. "Second octant, touch of a garby farmer."
"Nice," Wayne said. "Draw out the end of your sentences. Pitch them lower. Get some real toofy into that voice."
"Is this better?"
"Yeah, actually," Wayne said, sitting up. "That's damn good."
"Tensoon would be proud," Milan said. "I can still get a difficult accent right when I need to."
"Difficult," Wayne said. "The toofy accent?"
"With a garby farmer."
"Common mix," Wayne said. "Once I had to do a guy who grew up on the northwestern coast, raised by deaf parents, only talking once in a while, who had then moved in with the terrorist fundamentalists up in the mountains there." Milan frowned as a servant bustled past carrying linen. Some of the executive staff were going to be staying through the night, what was left of it, and guest rooms needed to be prepared.
"I don't know if I can do that," Milan said, talking in a slow, deliberate way, with a hint of terrace and a lot of slurred words. "But it does sound like fun."
"Ha!" Wayne said, turning on the accent, which was actually more clipped than Milan had made it.
"Good. But you're trying too hard. Being raised by parents who can't hear doesn't make a chap stupid. He just looks at the world differently, see?" "Not bad," Milan said.
The next servant who passed them gave them a glare as she had to pick her way over their outstretched legs in the hallway.
"It's better if I have a hat," Wayne said. "A hat?"
"Sure," Wayne said. "Hats is a disguise for your brain. Helps you think like the person what wore it last. You want to know a guy? Put on his hat."
"Has anyone ever told you that you're surprisingly wise?" Milan asked.
"All the bloody time."
"They're idiots. You're not wise. You're playing them. You're doing this on purpose."
She grinned.
"I love it."
Wayne tipped his hat forward, smiling and leaning back again.
"I'm not lying about the hats, though. They do help." "Sure," Milan said. "Like bones."
He cracked an eye at her.
"Does it ever bother you? Knowing you might live forever?" "Bother me? Why would it? Immortality is damn convenient."
"Don't know about that," Wayne said. "Seems to me that it would be nice to finally be done, you know? It's like you're running a race, and you don't quite know where the end is, but you got an idea. And you only need to make it that far. I can do that, I figure. But you don't have no end."
"You actually sound like you want to die."
"Someday," Wayne said.
"Huh. Maybe I should get into politics."
Milan shook her head at him, seeming bemused.
"It can be daunting," she admitted a short time later.
to consider eternity, as harmony must see it. But any time I get bored, I can just live a new life.
Put on a new hat, Wayne said. Become someone else.
Switch it up. Be bold where once I was timid. Be crass where I was respectful. Makes life interesting. Dynamic.
She paused.
And there's something else. We can die if we want.
What? Just like that?
Kinda, Milan said. Don't know if you've read the accounts. They're blurry about this topic anyway. But near the end of the world of Ash, Ruin tried to take over the Chandra. Control them directly. Well, Tensun and those in charge, they were really terrified by that. So they planned, and we all talked. And about a century after the Katasandra, we figured out a way to stop our lives. Takes a little concentration, but sets the body into a spiral where we just end.
Nice, Wayne said, nodding. That makes a lot of sense. Always have an escape route planned. Oh, and your A's are still off. You carried them over from your own accent. They aren't nasal enough. Draw them out if you want to sound like a real toofy.
She cocked her head at him.
You're wasted as a human.
Nah, Wayne said. Oh, I barely had a few mouthfuls today.
He reached in his pocket and checked his flask.
Well, maybe a wee more than that.
No, I meant...
He grinned at her and she cut off, then grinned back. He tipped his hat to her, then closed his eyes and continued listening. A short time later, she stood up and started pacing the hall, and he could hear her saying her A sounds to herself as she walked. He listened for a good long while, catching nothing abnormal, though he was pretty sure the sanitation minister guy was lying about his education. That fellow had never been to the university, or if he had, he hadn't hung around long enough to pick up the proper words. Wayne was mulling this over when he heard something out front. A voice, faint, but unmistakable. He scrambled to his feet, causing Milan to jump.
Gotta go, he said. Watch the idiot.
But...
Be right back,
Wayne said, clutching his hat and running down the hallway, his long Ruffs-style duster flaring to the sides. He raced around the corner and dashed toward the front of the mansion.
He said to deliver it here,
the woman was saying to the butler,
so I've brought it. It was a simple task. He just needed something made. Hardly worth waking me.
She turned to him. A radiant, glorious woman, built like a good Ruffs fence. Just tall enough, lean, but strong, too. She had dark hair, which he'd compared to a pony's on several occasions, and it was right unfair that she should get mad, considering she kept it in a tail and everything. She wore trousers, because skirts were stupid, and boots, because stuff needed to be kicked. The whole world could be going wrong, but seeing her made him forget. He grinned. In return, she gave him her special scowl, the one just for him. It was how he knew she cared. That, and when she shot him, she tended to aim for places that didn't hurt too much.
She's with me, Wayne said, running up.
Like hell I am,
Renette said, but she let him steer her away from the butler.
And one wonders, the butler said from behind, how His Grace's life can be threatened when we're letting every dust rat in the city saunter up and...
He cut off as Renette spun, her pistol out. Wayne caught her arm in time to stop her from firing.
Dust rat? She muttered.
When's the last time you bathed? Wayne said.
Then winced.
Just, you know, curious.
Guns don't care if I stink, Wayne. I have things to do, and I don't like being ordered around.
She shook a little cloth pouch in her left hand. Behind, the butler had grown very pale. Wayne got her into the sitting room. She didn't stink, despite what she said. She smelled of grease and gunpowder. Good scents. Renette scents.
What is it?
Wayne asked, snatching the pouch once they were out of sight.
Something Wax asked me to make, Renette said. Who got killed over there?
She pointed toward the still-open secret door down to the safe room. Murder always caught her attention, if only because she'd want to see the bodies and judge how well the bullets tore up the flesh. Wayne rolled a small metal object from the pouch onto his palm.
a bullet. His hand started to shake. "Oh, for harmony's sake," Renette said, plucking the bullet from his hand before he could drop it. "It's not a gun, you idiot." "It's part of one," Wayne said, shoving his hand in his pocket and breathing deeply. He could hold a bullet. He did that all the time for Wax. The shaking subsided. Something seemed odd about that bullet, though. "So if I gave you a splinter of wood and told you it had once been in a rifle stock, you'd go to pieces then, too?" "Dunno," Wayne said. "You think I understand how my brain works?"
"I'd say there's a logical fallacy in that statement," Renette said. "Maybe two."
She tucked the bullet back into the pouch.
"Wax here?"
"No. He's off detectiving."
"Then you'll have to take this,"
she said, handing him the pouch.
"His note insisted it was important. Half powder, as he asked, piercing bullet, forged not to shatter."
He could hold the bullet. He took it, then tucked it away immediately in his duster. "See?"
"So, wanna go get a drink?" he said. "You know, when the city is safe. Or maybe before it's safe? I don't mind none if the pub's a little on fire while we drink."
"You know I'd sooner shoot myself, Wayne," she said with a sigh. "And Mizra would shoot me if, by chance, I did go, come to think of it."
Wayne frowned. That was nowhere near the vitriol he normally got from her.
"What's wrong?"
he asked. She shook her head, glancing back toward the entryway.
"It's bad out there, Wayne. People still on the streets, thronging together, shouting. I've seen crowds like this before, in the roughs. Usually right before a man got strung up, law or no law. Those were towns of 500. What happens when it's 5 million who start acting like that?"
"Probably the return of the Ashen World," Wayne said. "What better time to finally profess your long-requited love for a certain handsome fellow what don't mind none if you smell like the inside of a barrel of sulfur?"
She gave him the glare again. He grinned, but then she didn't shoot him, or even punch him.
Damn, this was bad.
"They're starting to gather outside," Renette said, distracted, "chanting slogans about the governor."
"I need to check that," Wayne decided.
If the governor wasn't going to let him in and watch him close up, maybe he could learn something about Bleeder's plans out in that crowd.
"Get back to your house, lock the doors, and keep your guns handy."
It was telling that she didn't offer the slightest objection to his order as he strode toward the door, out into the mists. Captain Aradel regarded the governor's writ as he would the last will and testament of a beloved family member, with both reverence and obvious discomfort.
"He names me Lord High Constable," Aradel said. "But, rosts, I'm no lord."
He looked up at Reddy and his other lieutenants.
"Perhaps," Reddy said. "The appointment conveys a title, sir."
"The governor can't just appoint someone to the peerage," Maracy said. "A new title has to be ratified by a council with a quorum of the major house seats in the city."
She bit her lip as soon as she said it. She didn't mean to be contrary. Aradel didn't appear to mind. He carefully folded the writ and slid it into his jacket pocket. She'd found him gathering a sizable force outside of headquarters, preparing to still malcontents and ring constabulary bells to let the people living nearby know that at least someone was patrolling this night. Phantom sounds floated through the mists. Distant shouts, clangs, screams. It felt like hell itself surrounded them, shrouded in a veil of darkness and fog.
"Sir," Maracy said, "the governor said that he wanted you to do two things. First, send a detachment to forcefully quell rioting in the city. Second, bring up a smaller force to guard him as he prepares to address the people near the mansion. You're not to turn protesters away there, but elsewhere in the city, sir, he counseled you to be firm of hand. Very firm."
"Rusting idiots deserve it,"
said Lieutenant Marilyn, a woman with short blonde hair.
"No need for bloodthirst, Lieutenant," Aradel said. "I seem to remember you cussing out the Hastings family with some regularity yourself."
"Doesn't mean I'm setting fire to the city," Marilyn said. "The High Houses being bastards doesn't excuse being bastards ourselves, sir."
"Well, the mansion seems a good enough center from which to operate," Aradel said. "Chip, you and the messengers run to the other constables general and ask them to meet me at the governor's mansion with their officers. We'll coordinate the city lockdown from there. Everyone else, let's double-time it that way. If His Grace wants to talk to the people, I want a nice, thick barrier of police bodies between him and his constituents. Understand?
The group bustled into motion, the bell ringers setting out in front, the messengers scattering, one even taking to the skies. Chip was one of the coin shots. The rest of the constables fell into a march. An uneven one. They weren't soldiers, but no less resolute.
Sir, Marcy said, walking quickly up to Aradel. There's something else I need to tell you, if you can spare a moment.
How important is it? Aradel asked, pausing at the side of the group.
Very.
Reddy cleared his throat behind them.
Perhaps you should discuss it while traveling to the mansion, sir, if the governor really is planning to address the crowds.
Yes, Aradel said. Innate suddenly appointed me Lord High Constable. That immediately worries me about what other kinds of impulsive things he's capable of doing tonight. Let's do this on the move, Combs. Ready? Bring along the rest of the constables as smartly as you can. I'm going to the mansion ahead of you.
Marcy nodded. The things she wanted to discuss would be best said in the privacy of a carriage anyway. Except...
Idiot,
she thought, as Aradel jogged over to a group of horses in constable livery, reins held by a corporal. The carriage she'd been contemplating pulled away, loaded with equipment, most likely. Reddy grinned at her smugly. Marcy sighed. She'd been looking forward to maintaining her decorum tonight. Ah, well. She walked over and took a set of reins. Aradel was already in his saddle. He glanced at her, then raised a hand to his head.
Oh, of course. I didn't think...
Marcy swung up into the saddle, awkwardly bunching her skirt up between her legs, and sitting on part of it, revealing a generous expanse of leg.
It occurs to me, sir, Marcy noted, that Lady Constable uniforms could be distinctly more utilitarian.
We'll make a note of it, Lieutenant Combs.
He glanced toward the retreating carriage.
If you wish.
Sir, Marcy said, I believe the city is on fire. Perhaps we can discuss feminine modesty on another occasion?
Of course.
He nodded, and they set off in a clatter of hooves, trailed by two corporals with rifles in the scabbards on their saddles. The four horses quickly outpaced the larger group of constables, and even the carriage, as they rode through the mists. Marcy was glad of the darkness as it hid her furious blush. In compensation, she had gained the memory of Reddy's stunned expression, utterly shocked by what she'd done.
Well, why shouldn't she show her legs?
Historical precedent and simple practicality demanded that women be allowed into all professions. What lord would turn away a thug or a bloodmaker from his guards just because she had breasts? What constable office would pass up the chance to have every tin eye or coin shot they could get? What bank wouldn't jump at the chance to employ a terrace woman with copper mines? The thing was, women constables were also expected to be models of ladylike behavior. A holdover from the old days, reinforced by the speeches of Lady Aurean Ladrian soon after the Catassandra. There was just this blunt expectation that you would strive to remain feminine at the same time as you did your job. A heavy double standard to bear. At times, Marcy didn't mind. She liked dresses and nice hair and solving problems with a careful word instead of a fist to the face. To her, it was perfectly reasonable to be feminine and a constable. But did the men ever have to worry about being properly masculine while doing their jobs?
One social problem at a time, Marcy, she admonished herself, riding alongside Aradel.
Though she was going to buy some rusting trousers, riding this way was cold.
You ride well,
Aradel called to her as they slowed slightly from their initial burst away from the others. He led the way across a canal bridge, cutting across the middle of the third octant to get to the second.
I've had plenty of practice, Marcy said.
That's uncommon in the city these days, Aradel noted. A hobby?
You could say that,
Marcy said, blushing as she remembered her girlish fascination with the ruffs, lawmen, and Alamancer Jack stories. When her friends, well, acquaintances, had been given new coats for their birthdays, she'd begged for a ruff's duster and hat. Pure foolishness, of course. She'd completely grown out of that.
What is it you wanted to tell me? Aradel called.
Could we slow further for a moment?
He nodded and obliged, to the point where the horses were maintaining a brisk walk. Maracy opened the purse she'd slung over her shoulder and thrust the letters at Aradel. She hadn't consciously realized how eager she'd been to pass them on to someone else, so that the responsibility they represented wouldn't rest solely on her. Aradel took them.
"What's this?" he asked quietly.
"You remember telling me to snoop around the governor's place if I got the chance?"
"I remember telling you, with great circumspection, to keep your eyes open, Lieutenant."
"I did, sir. I kept my hands open, too, in case something damning happened to fall into them."
"Harmony, what did you find?"
"Letters," Maracy said, "from Innate to various ladies and lords in the city, arranging for the purchase of political favors and the suppression of legislation they didn't want. Sir, they're annotated in his own hand, and they match my records of suspicious events during his tenure as governor. During the ride to bring you the writ, I read through them, and I'm convinced he's just as corrupt as his brother was."
Aradel gave no outward reaction of either surprise or outrage. He wrote in silence, gripping the letters, eyes forward.
"Sir?"
Maracy finally asked.
"You put me in a difficult position, Lieutenant."
"Sir, I'd say that the governor has put you in that position, not me."
"How legally did you obtain these?"
"That depends," Maracy said, "on how the courts would interpret your authority to investigate when there is reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing, and whether or not you were justified in authorizing me to act."
"In other words, you stole them?"
"Yes, sir."
Aradel tucked them away.
"It doesn't mean we shouldn't protect him, sir," Maracy offered. "Until proven guilty in court, he's still the rightful leader of the city. This isn't the roughs, where we can just stride up and shoot someone, then publish our reasons later."
"The mere fact that you feel you need to point that out," Aradel said, "means you've been spending too much time with your coin-shot friend, Combs. I'm not considering avoiding my duty. I'm just thinking of all these people and their rioting. And they're right. They are being robbed by the system. Ruin. We were supposed to be better than this. What if the Lord Mistborn saw us now?"
"I suspect," Maracy said, "he'd tell us to do something about the situation."
Aradel nodded curtly. When he offered no further commentary, Maracy kicked her horse back into a trot, and the Lord High Constable followed suit. Tradition held that today's Field of Rebirth looked exactly the same as on that day long ago when humankind had crept from the wombs of stone that Harmony had created. Though the city had claimed all of the surrounding area, this central ring of pleasant grass and gentle hills had been left as a monument to another time. Merwill Flowers brushed Wax's mist coat as he strode across the springy ground. The tradition that this place hadn't changed was pure stupidity. Surely when Breeze and Hammond had climbed out into the sunlight, they hadn't found grass that was perfectly manicured, or flowers that grew in careful lines. Did people who spoke of that tradition just ignore the benches and the pathways? The buildings? Surely Harmony hadn't left lavatories on the grassland for the convenience of visitors. At the center, the highest hill was topped by the half-museum, half-mausoleum, sheltering the tombs of the last emperor and the ascendant warrior. Their giant statues rose above, dominating the area. As Wax approached, he was surprised to find lamps on the low structure spilling light across the grass and flowers. A pair of constables guarded the door.
"Now just turn on back and don't make trouble," one of them called as Wax approached.
Wax ignored the order, striding out of the mists and up to the men.
"The caretaker's called for your help, I assume?"
The two constables studied him, then reluctantly saluted. His reputation preceded him, though these men wore the patches of constables from the first octant. It was a precinct he hadn't often visited, but who else strode through the night in a mist coat with a shotgun strapped to his leg?
"They're worried about looters,"
one of the constables said, a squat fellow with a half-beard around his mouth.
Sir?"
"Wise,"
Wax said, striding past them and pushing into the mausoleum.
Sir?"
one of the constables said.
"They said not to let—" "Sir?"
Wax pushed the door shut as the two constables started arguing outside about whether they should stop him or not. He scanned the open foyer with its murals of the originators.